On November 9th, 2010, Cancer Action New York conducted a public forum on pollution and cancer in the village of Canton. The village of Canton is located in the region comprised of the St. Lawrence River Valley and the Adirondack, the Northern Adirondack Mountains. This forum was created so as to take a significant step toward reducing the public's exposure to persistent organic pollutants, dioxins, PCBs, PBDEs, these chemicals that accumulate in people's bodies. We feel it's very important to take a step in reducing this exposure, considering the fact that these chemicals are significant and major causes of cancer in the general public. Here in the St. Lawrence River Valley, there's an additional problem with the POPs exposure, considering the fact of the contamination of the fish with dioxins and Myrex and PCBs. So we brought this forum together. David Carpenter, MD, was our keynote speaker. Approximately 25 people attended the forum. There was a good representation of public and government at the meeting, and we're pleased with how the meeting went, and we are hopeful that this is one step that will lead to many more steps to reduce the POPs exposure of the residents of the St. Lawrence River Valley, the Adirondacks, and the rest of New York State. The next part of this file, this electronic file, is the unedited recording of Dr. David Carpenter speaking on persistent organic pollutant exposure reduction.
I really would like to have you ask questions as I go along. It's much more effective than trying to wait till I finish talking, so please feel free to interrupt me. I'm not going to talk specifically about cancer, although I'll certainly talk about cancer, but I've been working up here in this area since about 1985, primarily with the Mohawks at Akwesasne. And as I'm sure everyone here must realize, you have three aluminum foundry plants on the St. Lawrence River, Alcoa, Reynolds Metals, and General Motors. They all use PCBs as hydraulic fluids, and when they leaked, they washed them into the grass, the St. Lawrence, and the other tributaries to St. Lawrence, so that the Mohawks, who were traditionally a fish-eating population, were exposed to high levels of PCBs by eating fish. So a lot of my work draws on studies we've done there. And as everyone else, they're not exposed only to PCBs, although that's the major local source, but they're exposed to chlorinated pesticides. DDT, Myrex, hexachlorobenzene were the ones that we monitor in our analytical lab. But we're all exposed to those compounds, and I can guarantee you that we could detect them in the blood of every person in this room. The real question is, what diseases result from exposure to those chemicals? And of course, there are many other chemicals that I haven't worked with specifically, but let me focus on this group, which we call persistent organic pollutants. The reason they're persistent is these are chemical structures. The PCB molecule is actually very simple. It's two benzene rings coupled together, and instead of hydrogens around the rings, they can have various numbers of chlorines. So it's a mixture of 209 different possible chemicals, depending on how many chlorines and where they are in the rings. But they all have some common properties. They're fat-soluble, they're lipophilic, so they're stored in our body fat, not in muscle or other tissues. But we can make measurements of these by taking a blood sample, because in all of our blood, on average, we have about 2.5% of a blood sample is going to be fat. And if you have someone that's fasting when the blood is drawn, that fat is going to be in equilibrium with all the body fat. So you can take a blood sample, it's not very invasive, and you can tell somebody what their exposure level is. What we've done in the studies I've been involved in, and it's primarily with the Mohawks, but also with some other populations along the Hudson River, along the Housatonic River in Massachusetts, and more recently in Anniston, Alabama, the people that live around the Monsanto plant that manufactured most of the PCBs that were used in the Messina area and everywhere else. There were actually two Monsanto plants, one in East St. Louis and the other in Anniston. And I've been involved in health studies there. All right, let's back up and talk about persistent organic pollutants in general. So I already said they're persistent because our body can't break them down very well. And in fact, it takes about 10 years for our body to get rid of half of the PCBs we had for dinner tonight. And that's a real problem because as we grow older, the levels in our bodies almost always increase. And that's because we take them in more rapidly than we can break them down. And this will be very relevant when I get to the last part of my talk, which is contaminants in animal fats, because that's our major source of exposure. But so in people like the Mohawks that eat a lot of fish from contaminated rivers, they do have higher levels in their blood than most of us. But not that much higher. And they stay in their body for a long period of time. Now, what's happened? Our first studies at Akwesasne were geared at trying to prove that people had higher levels if they ate a lot of local fish. And we did demonstrate that. And after we did, the elders in the community began to advise people not to eat local fish. Some people followed that advice, some people didn't. But in general, their levels had been going down, even when we resampled the same people. If they stopped eating a lot of fish, slowly their levels are declining. The same pattern is true for these chlorinated pesticides. Now, PCBs were outlawed for manufacture and use in the U.S. in 1977. There was an electrical transmitter in front of my house, and I live in a farm in just outside of Albany, and that transformer leaked a few years ago, and that was pure PCB mixtures. So while they haven't been added to new manufacturing things, we still have a lot in use. When the World Trade Center blew up, there was horrendous PCB contamination, and that was from PCBs that were used to insulate electric wires that Con Edison had in those buildings. And during the fire, those volatilized. People could demonstrate high levels of PCB on glass, on window glass, on the outside of the glass. So everybody was breathing that in and spread around. So, while they've been outlawed, they're still around. The same is true for DDT. We haven't manufactured DDT. You're not supposed to have used it in the U.S. for years. Every one of us have DDT in our bodies. And we get it from eating fish, but also from eating beef and chicken and pork and drinking whole milk and eating butter and eggs. We'll get to that a little bit later. The other major persistent organic is dioxin. Now, dioxin was never intentionally manufactured except for research purposes. But dioxin is a byproduct of burning, especially of burning plastics. And this is one of the reasons that Don and other people, including me, lobbied so hard to prevent this backyard trash burning. And it's why, thanks to the Clean Air Act, now our incinerators are no longer spewing out huge amounts of dioxin. Up until, a little less than 10 years ago, I think 2000, about 10 years ago, the major source of new dioxins in the U.S. was municipal incinerators. And then the Clean Air Act was passed, and standards were set, and that was dramatically reduced. And now the major source in the U.S. is backyard trash burnings. But dioxins are a proven human carcinogen and are very, very dangerous at very low levels. Now, PCBs and these chlorinated pesticides are rated by the World Health Organization, by the U.S. government, as probable human carcinogens. And the reason they're only rated as probable is in every one of these cases, they are proven to cause cancer in animals if you give rats or mice the pure compounds. But the fact is, all of us have DDT, we have Myrex, we have hexachlorobenzene, we have chlordane, we have all these different pesticides in our body. So when we get cancer, how can you say it was this compound and not others? And so that's the only reason they're rated as probable human carcinogens. Now, the other important point on cancer, and I know that this is supposed to be a meeting on cancer, and I'm not going to talk a lot about that because most of my studies have been focused on other diseases. But the other point on cancer is the Environmental Protection Agency sets these standards for how you determine risk of different chemicals. And their assumption for carcinogens, based on a lot of evidence, is that if something causes cancer, there is no threshold, no dose of that substance that doesn't increase the risk of cancer. So they assume there's a linear dose response curve, which means in lots of the animal studies or even in the human studies, you're looking at relatively high doses because we all have some of these. So you look at the extreme population. But their assumption is that even one molecule is going to increase your risk of cancer, probably not at a level that any scientist is ever going to determine, but there is no safe dose. And this is really why it's so important that we find ways of reducing our exposure, getting rid of these chemicals in the environment. They're not only persistent in our bodies, they're persistent in the environment because bacteria can't break them down very easily. Some of these PCBs in the environment have half-lives. That means it takes decades or even centuries to get rid of half of what's there. I work right next to the Hudson River, contaminated by General Electric, not by General Motors. And they stopped using PCBs again in the late 70s when they were outlawed by the federal government. But the recent evidence indicates that 90% of the PCBs that were dumped into Hudson are still there. Now, the 10% that aren't there primarily washed out into the Atlantic Ocean, volatilized, went into the air, and spread all around the world, and a few percent were broken down. So we've got a real problem with the level of contamination. And, you know, you see dredging around, at least around the Reynolds site and the GM site at Akwesasne, taking out the contaminated sediments because they're not going to go away. All right, so what diseases do these chemicals cause? And I should say that this whole class of chemicals cause somewhat the same pattern of disease. We're finding that there are some subtle differences, that one class is more related to this disease and a different class more related to that, but they all do pretty much the same thing, and they're all persistent. Now, the other thing about these are the chemicals that are part of the 2001 Stockholm Convention. Conventions are what the United Nations does. They don't have any real power, but a UN convention is when the countries of the world agreed to take action to stop manufacture of and use of various substances. So the 2001 Stockholm Convention identified the Dirty Dozen, which were dioxins, PCBs, and then 10 of these chlorinated pesticides. And that convention's been signed by, I think, 198 countries. Interestingly, U.S. is not one of them. But it's a global effort to get rid of these compounds because they're so dangerous. Interestingly, the only exception was made for DDT because in tropical countries with a high rate of malaria, DDT is still the most effective agent for killing mosquitoes. And malaria does kill more people in those countries, especially children, than diseases caused by DDT exposure. although there's a major effort to try to find alternatives that will get the mosquitoes but not harm the people as much as DDT does. All right, so we've talked about cancer. These are carcinogens. It's been impossible to study cancer in the Mohawk population because it's a population of 12,000 people, and that's simply too small. You have to study cancer in much larger populations than that. So we have not done studies there focused on cancer. These chemicals reduce the immune system. Now, a variety of environmental agents alter immune system function. Why is that important? Because the immune system determines your response to infection, and it also determines your response to allergies. So metals, for example, will cause allergies, autoimmune diseases. PCBs, dioxins, chlorinated pesticides suppress the immune system. And what this has the effect of is causing people to get more infections, and when you get an infection, to get it more seriously. And most people are totally unaware of this. When you get a bad cold that lasts all winter, you don't think about the fact that it may have been because you were exposed to these chemicals that are influencing your immune system function. Now, some of the results I presented last night at this meeting in Geneva, we've looked at rates of hospitalization for respiratory infections, for chronic bronchitis, for chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which has an immune component, but it has some other components as well, for pneumonia. And we find that people living near waste sites that have high levels of PCBs and chlorinated pesticides and dioxins have more frequent hospitalizations for respiratory infections. It's as simple as that. Now, the specific studies we've done, let me tell you about the specific studies we've done in Akasazi, because these are important. First of all, we had three different groups of human health studies. We had one group which was headed by Professor Larry Schell in our anthropology department at the University of Albany. And he looked at adolescents, 10 to 16-year-olds, and he's continued to follow these people up to the present. I'm part of his project there now. They're no longer that age. Our present project is looking at reproduction in young women and issues on menstrual cycle and that sort of thing. But in that study, what Larry and his people showed was the higher the PCB level, the younger the age that the girls would reach puberty. Now, is that a disease? No, it's not really a disease, but it's an environmental agent altering the physiologic process. Now, interestingly, he also looked at lead exposure. The higher the lead level, the later the age at which the girls reach puberty. So these compounds alter endocrine function. The reason that PCBs cause puberty at a younger age is that they mimic the female sex hormone estrogen. Now, the PCB level also was related to how obese the adolescents were. We have this epidemic of obesity, and now in the last few years, everybody's finding a whole variety of chemicals, not just PCBs, but bisphenol A and phthalates and some metals are associated with a greater tendency to be obese. That is a real disease. The other thing that was done in these studies of adolescents related to disruption of endocrine systems was clear demonstration that PCBs interfered with thyroid function. Thyroid hormone is this gland in our neck. It regulates our metabolism. Almost everybody knows what a cretin is. A cretin is a grossly mentally retarded person that's born without an adequately functioning thyroid. If your thyroid doesn't work right, your brain doesn't work right. If your thyroid doesn't work right as an adult, and it's very common, especially in women more than men, and nobody knows why women are more vulnerable, you tend to be sleepy, have no energy, often overweight, often dry skin, and it doesn't get diagnosed very often. It's actually relatively easy treatable, but it doesn't get diagnosed very often. So it's a clear disease. PCBs reduce thyroid function. We demonstrated that most convincingly in these adolescents, and then later we had a student that looked in an adult population, and he could demonstrate clinical hypothyroidism more common in people, especially in women, with elevated PCB levels. A lot of my work has been study of the brain and brain and behavior. And actually, this is how I first got involved in studying PCBs, because I was very involved in lead poisoning. Everybody knows kids exposed to lead early in life have a reduced IQ. And not only a reduced IQ, but they tend to be more aggressive, have a shorter attention span, be more disruptive. They have the whole syndrome that we otherwise know as ADHD. So they're problem kids. And the question is their IQ reduced because of some effect of lead on the brain? Or is it that they can't pay attention, so how can they learn? Well, PCBs do exactly the same thing. Exactly the same thing. And in studies that I've done in my lab with animals, we could demonstrate that the mechanisms seem to be the same. Now, they can't operate through exactly the same pathways, because lead's a metal, PCBs are an organic compound. But they do cause a reduction in IQ. Now, in the studies we did on adolescents, I shouldn't use that term too easily, because nobody was outside of the, quote, normal range of IQ. It wasn't that these kids were all retarded. But if you look at the range of PCBs in the children, what you find is those with higher PCBs do less well on tests of intelligence and memory. And then we went on and did the same study in adults, a different population of adults. We found basically the same thing. And some of these adults were sufficiently old that they were not exposed to a lot of PCBs when they were a kid. So just because we're older doesn't mean that these compounds don't interfere with our learning ability and our memory. To my mind, that's probably one of the most dangerous effects that you can have from an environmental exposure, because these reduction of IQ is, you know, it impacts your whole quality of life, your learning ability, your earning ability. And there's a lot of evidence that, especially with early life exposure, that these effects are irreversible. That's certainly demonstrated for lead. So, immune system effects on sex hormones, and effects on IQ and learning ability. I should go back to the sex hormones, because a study we've done more recently looked at men and looked at their serum testosterone level in relation to their serum PCB level. So we know that the PCBs mimic estrogen, but we demonstrated in adult Mohawk men that the higher the PCB level, the lower their testosterone level. And I've always said that Pfizer really ought to support our project, because probably the sale of Viagra is because of all the PCBs that men have that reduce their testosterone that cause erectile dysfunction. And that's really no joke, because the serum testosterone level is what drives sexual activity in the males. And interestingly, we did not find much of a change with age. The change was much more dependent on the serum PCB level. So, you know, these things, they seem to affect almost every organ system. Well, the other things that we've been doing more recently have been focusing on the chronic diseases that nobody thinks about as being related to environmental exposures, and that is diabetes, heart disease, and high blood pressure. Now, the high blood pressure we've studied primarily in different populations, so let me leave that till last. Diabetes. We published a paper in 2006 showing that the higher the PCB level, if we divided the Mohawks into three groups on the basis of the lowest third of PCB level, the second, the median third, and the highest third. And then we adjusted for their age, for whether they were men or women. We adjusted for how their body mass index, which is a measure of obesity. And then we found that comparing those people with the lowest third of PCBs to those with the highest third, the chance in the highest third was 3.9-fold that they were a greater risk for diabetes. Now, we got scooped by about a year from a different group, and this is just blurgeon. There are a whole host of papers now in the last few years showing this relationship between diabetes and exposure to this whole class of chemicals. Let me tell you about the paper that beat us, because I think it's really a great paper. It used this random sample of Americans. Lead author was from Korea, but she was using the U.S. database. Her name was Lee. It was published in Diabetes Care in 2006. So it used a random sample of Americans. It got their levels of PCBs, of chlorinated pesticides, and of dioxins, which we didn't measure in our Mohawk population. And it got their fasting glucose level and various other indicators of diabetes and all of the medications they were taking. So if they were diagnosed with diabetes by a physician, that went into the database. And they looked at one dioxin, one dibenzofuran, which is a compound related to dioxin, one PCB, and three chlorinated pesticides. For the PCB, they found if they went by sextile, so divide the PCB levels in six groups and then adjust for all these other factors, they found a six-fold, if I remember correctly, 6.8, I think, fold excess risk of diabetes in the highest group as compared to the lowest group. If they looked at all six of these chemicals that they measured and compared the lowest 1/6, the lowest 5% to the highest 5%, they found the highest percent were 38 times as likely to have diabetes as the lowest group. Nobody's demonstrated this for diabetes for anything. And the very interesting thing, if I'd asked all of you in advance what the biggest risk factor for diabetes is, you'd probably say obesity, lack of exercise and eating too much. That's the general sense in the medical community. What they found is that very obese people, if they did not have high levels of these contaminants, were at no elevated risk of having diabetes. Now, why are people fat? They're fat because they eat too much animal fat for the most part, and that's where all the contaminants are. Time's getting on. I don't want to talk much longer than another 5 minutes, but we're finding the same kinds of things with heart disease. We've published that for the Mohawks. Let me talk to you a little bit about hypertension. Again, nobody thinks of hypertension being related to environmental exposures except possibly smoking. I've been working with these people that live around the Monsanto plant in Alabama. There are a lot of lawsuits down there against Monsanto, which were won pretty much by the community. And I served as an expert witness in some of those lawsuits. And then Senator Shelby, because they only looked at measurements of PCB levels and no health outcomes, Senator Shelby of Alabama had the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry do a health study. So we got PCB levels, we got these clinical chemistries, and in this case we got three measures of blood pressure in these people. So we've studied the 360-some people that were not taking antihypertensive medication in relation to their levels of these PCBs and pesticides. We find an extraordinary association for people that have the lowest third of PCBs as compared to the highest third. For those that had elevated blood pressure, both for systolic and diastolic blood pressure, normal blood pressure is 120 over 80, so elevated is 140 over 90, we find a greater than five-fold increase in risk in the top third as compared to the bottom third. And not only that, we find that even people that have blood pressure in the normal range, that's less than 140 and less than 90, that their blood pressure is greater if their PCB level is higher. So as with the thyroid hormone, as with the IQ, these compounds are altering function in what has always been considered normal range. All right, how do we get rid of these compounds? And how do we all get exposed to them? Well, human exposure can be one of three ways. You can eat them or drink them, you can breathe them in, or you can absorb them through the skin. Now, it's almost certain that the greatest route of exposure is eating them. And that's really what we're here to talk about tonight. I think there's been an underappreciation of how important breathing them in is, because we've done these studies showing that just living by these sites increases your exposure. So it isn't just eating them. And if you go wading in contaminated sediments, well, you can absorb them through the skin. But how do most people, let's not talk about the Mohawks because they're sort of a special case because they eat all these contaminated fish. Most of us eat fish, and fish contain some contaminants. They're much greater if it's fish that are caught in contaminated waters. But, you know, the oceans have some contamination. As I said, all the PCBs left the Hudson River have flown out into the Atlantic Ocean. I've been involved in studies on farmed salmon. Farmed salmon contain high levels of PCBs, chlorinated pesticides, dioxin, and it's because of the food they're fed. They're fed a concentrated fish oil, and that fish oil contains some level of contaminants. If you concentrate it, it makes the farmed salmon dangerous to eat, much worse than wild salmon. But the Food and Drug Administration did a what they call a market basket survey. They went into supermarkets and they just took food samples and they analyzed them for dioxins and PCBs. And what they found is that every kind of animal fat, whether it's beef, pork, chicken, dairy products, eggs, they all contain dioxins and PCBs. And the question is, where does this come from? And it's almost certain that for most of us that don't live by a PCB-contaminated site, that's the source of our exposure to these chemicals. Well, I served on a National Academy of Science panel a few years ago on the subject of dioxin-like compounds in the U.S. food supply. We had presentations from the Food and Drug Administration, from the Department of Agriculture, and the conclusion from that report, which was published, I think, in 2003, was that the source of the contaminants in the food is primarily because U.S. agriculture feeds waste animal fats to the animals that we eat. Now, you butcher a cow, you've got a whole pile of fat that nobody wants. It's called tallow. Some of it's used to make soap. But now in the days of liquid soap, even that market's pretty well gone. So what do? Well, you got to get rid of it. And while cows are not normally carnivorous animals, they eat grass and hay and grain, but they grow faster if you give them extra fat. So commercial cattle food contains a lot of waste animal fats. Now, we had a big scare a few years ago on mad cow disease. Sufficiently big scare that the Department of Agriculture ruled that you could no longer feed cow fat to cows. So now we feed the cow fat to the pigs and the chickens. We feed the pig and the chicken fat to the cows. And we throw in a little bit of fish oil and fish meal in addition. And this is economically worthwhile to the farmer. The slaughterhouses can sell their waste products. And what this does is recycle all the contaminants that got into the animals, into people, 20, 30 years ago when there were not restrictions on releases of dioxin from incinerators, when we still manufactured PCBs, and we manufactured DDT. We keep recycling it back in our food. And we all eat too much fat. That's true. But in the process of eating too much fat, we get these contaminants in our body. Now, that report, with very clear recommendations, was out in 2003. Nothing has happened since then. There's no regulation. There's no reduction on the recycling of waste animal fats. And First, and secondly, the majority of the public doesn't even know about this. They have no knowledge of this fact at all, that you can't have a nice steak without getting someone's waste pig and chicken fat. And now, from a point of view of public health, these things cause so many diseases. Now, let's go back to cancer for a moment, because I was on the President's Cancer Panel almost two years ago. But the President's Cancer Panel final report came out just a few months ago. And it draw the firm conclusion that most cancers are caused by environmental exposures. The study that I really like was a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2000 from Sweden, where they did a study. They have a very good twin registry in Sweden. And they asked the question, how many cancers are caused by genetics and how much is caused by environmental exposures? And they reasoned that identical twins, since they have the same genes, if genetics causes cancer, that all identical twins should get the same cancer. And if it's environmental exposures, then they wouldn't, and non-identical twins, they have the same environment, they looked at both identical and non-identical twins. Their conclusion was that 85% of cancer was not caused by genes, but was caused by environmental exposures. That's totally consistent, or I should say the President's Cancer Panel conclusion is consistent with that conclusion. Interestingly, the two cancers that had the strongest genetic component were breast cancer. We do know about some of the specific genes involved in breast cancer, although it's a minor percent. And the other is prostate cancer. So these are hormonally dependent cancers, so there's a stronger genetic component. So, I think the issue, cancer kills more people than any other disease in this country except for heart disease. And there are certainly more carcinogens than just these persistent organics. But we know those are, dioxin is a proven human carcinogen. We know it's in our food supply, and our government's not doing anything to get it out. Now, I keep getting asked the question, what can people do? What can local governments do? What can state governments do? Well, obviously, local governments, state governments have relatively limited ability to influence federal policy. We as individuals have limited ability, but we have some ability. And we have the ability to speak to our legislators, to inform people, to let people know what causes cancer and some of the logical things we can do about it, which is to take these chemicals out of our food supply. We can educate people at a local level. That isn't dependent on federal action. We can push our elected representatives to stop this practice. Now, I have a farm. I understand something about agriculture. I grew on a farm. Of course, there's a real need to be efficient and to try to make money. But making money through agriculture by exposing the whole U.S. population to chemicals that cause carcinogens is not right. When there's a perfectly reasonable way, maybe a little more expensive, if you want to feed fats to animals that don't normally eat fats, feed them vegetable oils. They don't contain these organic contaminants. Oats and wheat and corn don't eat fish. Soybeans don't eat fish. It's more expensive. It's economics that's driving the whole thing. So I think we're really concerned about these policies that have to be done at a federal level, but they're only going to respond at a federal level if we at a local level push them. We really need to educate our local populations so that this gets on the table with our members of Congress and with our elected officials at every place. So let me stop there. I didn't get interrupted with any questions, but I'd welcome any questions that you have. Yeah.
Well, this would be a somewhat indirect way of influencing this policy, but it seems to me that it's one thing to argue, okay, to switch over to vegetable fats as a supplement for the following reasons, and those are all good reasons. But then you still have this unsalable animal fat product, and if you could come up with a alternative use for that that would be profitable, that might make the policy easier to implement. And what I'm thinking is maybe that could be turned into, be part of this whole biofuels.
Precisely. I served on the governor's renewable fuels task force.
Okay.
And this was actually one of the things we talked about.
Okay.
Now, one of the problems there, the problems with biodiesel, for example, is it's a little more viscous. So in cold weather,
yes,
it doesn't work. And you take tallow or lard, you'd have to do something to make them less
viscous.
Well,
you have to blend it with regular diesel. Yeah.
And then the question is, if you put dioxins and PCBs in your car engine, what comes out the tailpipe?
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think anybody's really looked at that carefully. I think that may be a big concern.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we know with incinerators that you burn your plastic, you form dioxins, but if you have the temperature high enough, you then break down the dioxins. But it's something like, what, 1,400 degrees?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure that it might be a way of getting rid of the waste fats, but I'm not sure it's going to solve the problem.
Yeah.
You don't want these things spewing out the tailpipe.
It may be just redistributing.
That's right.
Can it be removed? I mean, can the contaminants be removed before it goes into the...
And that's a very good question. I think the answer is yes, but the issue is how costly is it? Now, I suspect there are a few people here that take fish oil supplements. Well, I've gotten very involved in fish oil supplements because, you know, we've shown all these contaminants in fish fat. And it's complicated because there's a lot of evidence that these omega-3 fatty acids that are found in seafood are very good for us. But they're in the fatty fish that are the same ones that have all the contaminants. Well, so I was on a panel with a guy from a company that made these fish oil supplements, and he said, you know, our fish oil supplements don't have many PCBs in them. I didn't quite believe him, but I went home and tested some, and they don't have a lot. And the reason is they treat the fish oil with activated charcoal to take out the fishy taste and smell. And the activated charcoal absorbs a fair bit of the contaminants, not all of them. And then the really high-priced fish oils, they actually distill them. And that further purifies them. So it can be done. But, you know,
But that's a niche market.
That's a niche market. So whether, you know, that would probably not be very commercially profitable for all the waste animal fats. But again, you know, when you recognize a problem, we have a pretty good track record in this country of having people that can find cost-effective solutions if there's a motivation to do so.
Right.
Yeah.
About like all that ADHD and like the thyroid, I thought it was like passed down by generation.
Well, it isn't. It is not inherited.
Because
but the problem is that, well, I shouldn't say not at all, but the majority of ADHD is not inherited. Now, it does sometimes run in families. But families all eat the same food. And there's very little evidence that it's actually a genetic change. Although if the parent had ADHD, there is a greater...
My dad does and I do.
Yeah.
My mom has bipolar, I do. And my nana has thyroid, I do. My mom has hypoglycemia and I do too.
Well, you know, I'm certainly not saying that there's no genetic component, but families all tend to have the same diet. And if contaminants are associated with these diseases, it's not surprising that you see the same diseases. Now, bipolar is a little different, but ADHD, pretty strong evidence that ADHD is primarily an environmental exposure. And, you know, we're all exposed to these, and most people don't know about it. Yeah.
So I missed the beginning of what you said. You may have addressed this, but if you eat organically raised animal products, or if you don't eat any animal products, or if you manage to keep your weight low enough that you basically don't have much in the way of excess fat, is your life outlook better?
Well, let me deal with the last one first, because if you are overweight and you lose a lot of weight, your concentration of contaminants will actually increase. Now, if you are never overweight and you keep your weight under control because you don't eat a lot of animal fats, whether you're a vegetarian or at least you don't eat a lot, that does dramatically reduce your exposure to these contaminants. And I forgot your first question, which was?
Organically raised.
I just had an interview with the radio station tonight on organically raised salmon. We've actually monitored some organic salmon, which I don't think is a possible. You can't have an organic fish, but the organic salmon had higher concentrations of PCBs than even the farm salmon. So organic fish are not possible. How you define organic. If by organic you mean you don't add any chemicals, but you don't pay attention to what you feed your animals, then that's not organic. If organic in the place of organic beef, what it's supposed to mean is you feed them only grass, hay, and grains without any antibiotics, without any supplements that would accumulate. And then, yes, dramatically reduces exposure. Organically grown vegetables don't have pesticides on them. The problem with these organic salmon is they say what they're feeding. They don't add any antibiotics to the tank, but they're feeding them a natural product, which is fish meal, fish oil taken from the ocean, and that happens to be contaminated. So it isn't no net gain. Yes?
But to the same kind of question referring to eggs, if they are cage-free and able to be free-range, does that decrease your likelihood of contaminants?
Well, free-range by itself doesn't mean that they're not given food.
No, okay.
And so it's what the birds are fed that's really important. Free range is good for the health of the bird. But if you're still feeding your chickens a commercial mixture of food that contains cow fat, then you're going to end up with PCBs and pesticides in your eggs. And that's whether they're caged or whether they're free range.
What I meant by free range is they're eating grass or natural foods rather than being supplemented.
Right. If they're fed oats and corn and not a commercial supplement, it's these commercial supplements where the feed companies mix in these animal fats. And most of the farmers don't realize that at all. They may advertise that this contains certain level of fat, and that will help your animals grow, but they never ask the question, where did that fat come from?
Getting back to your earlier point about the extremely long half-life and the persistence of these organic compounds, has anybody begun to assess if we could actually implement a policy shift, how long it would take us to effectively, cleanse, this kind of systemic organic pollution that's persistent.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the calf stock that's weaning on milk.
Exactly.
I mean, how long would it take us to effectively have a measurable change, a meaningful measurable change in even in background contamination, if we could implement?
policy change?
Well, I used to think it was, I was so pessimistic that I thought it would take generations. But we've gone back with the Mohawks and resampled some people that we tested in the early 90s. And at 10 and 15 years, these people stopped eating the contaminated fish, and their PCB levels had fallen to less than half. Now, that's sort of consistent with what I said. The half-life is maybe 10 years. Now, they presumably had other inputs just than the fish, but the fish were a big thing. So I think it is possible to have these background levels fall much more rapidly than one thinks. Now, levels in the people is one thing. We could stop the levels in the contaminated food tomorrow.
Right.
If we, most of it, not perhaps all of it, but most of it, just by banning this recycling of animal fats. It's about the only place that animals we eat get exposed to these things. The other factor here is so many of these diseases, it's the kids that are most vulnerable, especially the younger kids. And that's what I see is making this so urgent that we not let the next generation grow up with the same contaminant levels that we have. Just think how brilliant we would all be if we hadn't been exposed to all these chemicals. And, it really, people sometimes care more about their dogs than they even do their kids, but they care more about their kids than they do the rest of the human race. And so I think that really is a reason to try to do everything we can to reduce exposure quickly. Yeah?
About the gas being turned into oil, what if they had a filter that would filter out the bad chemicals using the coal because it kind of attracts them? Kind of like you purify water.
Yes. I mean, I think the activated charcoal is what's... Now, this is a general problem. Another issue I've been involved in are the pharmaceuticals in our drinking water. Because drinking water treatment plants, they remove everything that's bound to contaminant, bound to sediments, but they don't remove things that are dissolved in the water, unless you have a very strong activated charcoal treatment, and even then some of them escape. But I think the technology needs to be developed, but people. In our schools of engineering and so forth, if you give them a motivation to find technology, they'll do it.
But of course, the real answer to pharmaceuticals is to make it easy for people to get rid of them in a proper way instead of.
No, that's true. But even that's not going to solve the problem of. When you take a pill,
you
excrete it.
Yeah,
right.
And, birth control pills, lipid-lowering pills, antipsychotic pills, they're either excreted in the urine or the feces, and that you're not going to stop that.
Right.
But dumping waste, extra pills down the toilet, that's a big deal. That was actually part of the press conference that Andrew Cuomo held when he was still Attorney General. I guess he still is, but he was going after some of the healthcare facilities in the New York City watershed because they were flushing all their extra medication down the toilet. And I think it was mainly a show, but to raise the issue that that's not something that any of us should do. But that's not going to stop the overall problem, which is a lot of the excretion of the medicines we take. Yeah?
Some of the food information we've been given from the Center for Science and the Public Interest and then health professionals tell you don't ever eat margarine because it's just so full of all these chemicals.
Yes, trans fats.
Right, and now we're also saying don't eat butter because we don't know what the cow was fed that made the milk that made the butter. So,
My students in my environmental health class always tell me what I taught them is it's not safe to breathe the air, drink the water, and eat the food.
So it's very hard to know who to believe.
Other than that.
So who do you, how do you, you know, how do you make decisions on what it is you're going to do?
Well, you know, I think, first of all, we all have to be realistic. You know, the life is full of risks. I like to use the example that I like my wood stove. I know it's not healthy. It makes indoor air pollution, but I like the smell. I like the appearance. And I also like peanut butter. And peanut butter is full of aflatoxin, which causes liver cancer. And, you know, but I'm aware of those risks, and I make a choice. I think the critical thing, I mean, there are people, we were talking tonight, people that smoke and know the risks and make a choice. What we shouldn't tolerate is ignorance. And, of course, nobody can find a perfectly risk-free environment. That just doesn't exist. But we should know what the risks are. We should know how relative important they are. And we should then make choices about how we eat, how we live, that reflects our own value of the benefits versus the risk of these things we do. Yeah?
I think we should, like, start informing schools, because if the younger generations find out, they'll actually take it seriously and maybe tell their parents, and then their parents will be aware, because a lot of schools don't actually take it seriously.
Oh, I totally agree with that. I think that really is where there needs to be information.
That was a big part of the genesis of the anti-smoking.
Right.
They targeted it directly.
That's right, and the kids beat on their parents until they stop smoking. Yeah. And, you know, I think where we have to target there, and that's what I do within my university, is try to get at the people that are going to be the teachers, because they're the ones that are going to be communicating with the kids. We've had some of our students that have actually gone into our local schools and caught sessions on asthma and asthma prevention and that kind of thing. But there just needs to be a much more general knowledge base than everybody.
The environmental club at the Kent School is really trying to bring awareness to the school.
Right.
And try to impact other schools as well so we can kind of join together.
Well, that's great. And it's, you know, that's, I think, something we all can do within our own communities is help increase awareness. The information is out there. It's just not very aware. One of my major goals is try to reach the medical community, because I'm working with all these diseases and finding these environmental associations that are extremely strong and I think are even stronger than the traditional risk factors of diet and exercise and so forth. Probably smoking is still more dangerous, but most physicians don't know this. They're not taught this in medical school. And so I've been trying, for example, our first paper on this blood pressure relationship to PCBs, we got published in the Journal of Hypertension with the major goal of trying to reach the physicians that treat people with blood pressure, because I don't think any of them know about this.
But yeah. Then what are the recommendations? I mean, they don't make a drug yet, but even if they did, just put in water. I mean, did you find in your studies that more exercise or antioxidants or eating green or eating red or orange or any certain foods would allow the body to get rid of these? Because usually anything that is a toxin for the body, there's something in nature that helps to, other than eating charcoal.
Well, we really... eating charcoal is actually maybe not such a bad idea. One of the big...
Oh, you've had my cooking.
That's the number one cancer cause.
Yeah, it's full of all those polyaromatic hydrocarbons that cause cancer. Yeah. Some people do actually take activated charcoal pills to absorb contaminants. It's a common treatment for diarrhea because it does absorb some toxins. But I think the real answer to your question is nobody has good solutions. The only way that I'm aware of that one can reduce your body burden of these chemical contaminants. Well, there are really two ways, but the most obvious one is to eat a non-absorbable fat. Pringles potato chips made with Olestra.
Oh.
Nice. They're vile. If you eat very many of them, you get a violent diarrhea. You lose all your fat-soluble vitamins. But this is how Yushchenko, the president of the Ukraine that was poisoned with dioxin, this is how he was treated. And his body burden...
Pringles
potato chips made with Olestra. You can buy them.
Wow. That's how he was treated?
That's how he was treated.
Interesting.
But, you know, there actually is a group in Rochester that's studying this. And my wife actually tried them. She has a weight problem, and she tried them, and she said she would never take them again. Because she apparently ate too many, and she just felt awful. But apparently if you start sort of one potato chip a day, and then you go to two, and then to three. And if you do that sort of, you stop it over the weekend, and you eat a lot of vitamins so you can absorb your fat-soluble vitamins, it's not a very realistic way.
Anything in the line of homeopathics? Because everything has a...
Nothing that's been demonstrated.
Okay.
Now, I actually... It's interesting. I've just gotten a grant to study a homeopathic treatment, which is basically sauna therapy and crystal of niacin on individuals suffering from the Gulf War syndrome. Nobody knows what that Gulf War syndrome is, but it's people that served in the first Gulf War have this syndrome of... It's very much like multiple chemical sensitivity. It's fatigue, a lot of nervous system symptoms, headache, muscle joint pains. Everybody's pretty sure it's some exposure, but nobody knows what it is. And so these homeopathic therapies may have some use, but they haven't been critically tested. Beyond that, I don't really know of anything. The other method that is again being done experimentally is some drastic surgery, which has been applied now for very obese people. You probably all heard about this, putting a band on the stomach so the stomach doesn't hold as much. And some of those people, if they have diabetes, it does slowly get better over time. But there's an even more drastic surgery where you take the small intestine and you graft the end of the jejunum or the top of the ileum into the stomach. So you bypass the first part of the small intestine. And those people, some of them are recovering from their diabetes in as short a time as a month. And nobody quite knows what the reason is, but again, I have a grant now pending with a colleague at Rochester who has the idea that the liver tries to get rid of all these contaminants, and it continually dumps them back into the small intestine from the blood. But the small intestine is very efficient at absorbing them all again. And so his hypothesis is that with these patients with this drastic surgery, that they're going to be excreting a lot of these contaminants in their feces, and that's why their diabetes is getting better. It'd be very interesting if that's the case. So it's not something...
How do they absorb the other vitamins and stuff?
Well, that's the other problem. They give high vitamin supplements to these people, but the fat-soluble vitamins particularly would be a problem because you're bypassing the bile. The idea is the bile, which helps absorb the fats, probably contains the PCBs and the pesticides and the dioxins, you're bypassing that so the levels fall. Now, we don't know if that's the case yet, but it's a reasonable hypothesis. Something to be tested. Yeah?
Did you ever do any detoxification with some of these people that are heavily, got a lot of these chemicals in them?
I have not, no. This Gulf War test will be the first that I've done. There are a few reports But they're not very good studies, and most people don't think they're credible. It's interesting. The Church of Scientology has this detoxification program. And anytime you utter the word Scientology, everybody thinks this is a terrible sect. And they actually approached me to do detoxification on people with high levels of exposure. But we were never able to get funding to do that. But this grant I have with the Gulf War is actually using some of those methods, which is crystalline niacin causes you to flush and you get a lot of itching, and it mobilizes fat stores. And their hypothesis is that increases the excretion of these chemicals. It's never been tested in a way that's convincing. But, you know, I'm not saying it doesn't work. That's right. And as a matter of fact, I used to treat myself with niacin because the medical texts will tell you that niacin, I use the slow release niacin, it lowers your triglyceride levels dramatically. I don't do that any longer, but one of the problems is that you can get some liver damage from doing that, and I was found to have elevated serum lipid levels, liver enzymes. So my doc took me off the niacin and put me on more traditional medications.
You mentioned earlier with mad cows and the practice of feeding animal fat to cows and eliminating the gluten. Is that still the case?
See, I don't think anybody demonstrated. The mad cow disease is supposedly only transmitted by brain tissue or nerves. But the problem is what they were using to make is a lot of the waste animal products in these cows, probably including the brain. You go to a slaughterhouse, they're going to use every part they can. So the bones make bone meal, the blood makes blood meal, the skins are tied for, are made into leather, and everything else is pretty much ground up and put in this feed, is my understanding. So, you know, who knows what's in that food, but so I don't think anyone's ever demonstrated that the waste animal fats were a cause of mad cow disease, but there was enough suspicion so that seemed a reasonable precaution.
But there's still
that prohibition is still in place. But not the cow fat, only the pig and the chicken fat now.
Okay. All right. It's fat laundering.
And you know, the, from the point of view of these prions, the things that cause mad cow disease, they're proteins that are misformed. If you feed them to a pig and then you eat the pig, there's no reason you couldn't get mad cow disease through that indirect route either. So it's not a very reasonable or rational step, I think. Well, Don, you wanted to make some comments.
If people are, if people are willing to stick around for a little longer, we've been going a little over an hour now. What we really were planning, and, we're not going to just do this if people aren't inclined to do it, we were hoping to, once Dr. Carpenter has spoken, and we just kind of had this message, basically his message is that these chemicals, these persistent organic pollutants that are in our food supply, in the animal fat, all the animal fat, they cause so much disease that we certainly don't want to continue having that much disease, and so we need to reduce those levels of those chemicals in all of our bodies, especially in young people's bodies, because they are more sensitive and more vulnerable to damages. So we think that the next step would be that, we would just get people talking about how can the kids and, some of the younger adults, the people who want to change, how can they know what he knows, in a relatively short period of time, so it isn't just that, this goes on for, what is the point in having the science, Well, I get frustrated that the science exists, not the fact of scientific process existing, but scientific knowledge, you know, this actual, this specific detailed knowledge exists because all the work that Dr. Carpenter and his colleagues have done, and these, all these other researchers around the world, thousands and thousands of people, that all exists, but it's not being used. There's no benefit accruing from this existence of this knowledge. Sure, it's great to research and research and research, but we need to also use what we've created through doing all the researching, and that's not happening. That is truly not happening. So I would like to have a discussion with people here about how that can become the old story and just a totally new situation where this science is used quickly to prevent disease. Yeah.
Awareness, like a auditorium thing, and we're gonna have like a fashion show of used clothes from thrift shops, so people will know that they can actually be fashionable and wear things, so they'll reuse it.
Yeah.
And I thought we could have like a rally or something on like all the work that he's done, so it'll be fun and not boring for the kids, but also like tell people what's going on.
Sure, sounds great. You know, the more things like that that happen, then people talk about that and they'll just have them more. Yeah. I think that is just a fantastic idea. You know, just to get people talking. Lou said it. Lou, if you want to say anything now, this is your well, when you said just start talking about it, you know.
Yeah, right, yeah. Yeah, so talk about it. Talk about all, you know, I have to say this, that they, whoever they are, knew the hazards of asbestos in 1897. I can't tell you the date that they stopped using that in commerce here in this country, but it's still being used around the world. But that's just an example of the problem we face with this problem of, you know, these persistent organic pollutants in the food supply. And I listened to an interview with a Dr. Chopra, and his name is, he's Shiv Chopra, and he worked, he was a veterinarian, and he worked for the Health Canada. That's the FDA equivalent in Canada. And he was fired from that job along with two colleagues because he refused to rubber stamp the recombinant bovine hormone. And he goes on to say that there's five things that should not be in the food supply. There are antibiotics, hormones, see if I can remember these. Pesticides, rendered animal fats, and GMO foods. He says none of these things should be in the food supply. So, and antibiotics, 70% of the antibiotics manufactured are used in animals. And they get into the food that we eat. So that's why there's a big problem with people being allergic to antibiotics and why the antibiotics are becoming ineffective.
And those antibiotics in the animal are not used to prevent disease.
No.
They're used to make them grow faster.
Make them grow faster. Make more fat faster. But that's I think, where we have to make some changes, and that is we have to encourage the food production people to stop doing it. And there's an easy way to do that, and that's with your dollars when you buy food. Don't buy the food it's made like that. Buy grass-fed beef, organic food. It's cheaper in the long run. And I also wanted to say something about detoxification. There was a question, what you can do to detox. There's a supplement that I've read that helps the detox, and that's chlorella. It's one of these single-cell algae program or plants, and that I've read that helps the detox.
I'd be pretty suspicious about that unless there's good evidence. But
what
it binds to usually metals, heavy metals detox.
Yeah. Well, you
know. Heavy metals. Another way you can detox from heavy metals is with chelating materials.
Yeah, but that's always very dangerous, and I think chelation should only be done under very good physician's care, because almost all the chelators aren't specific. They don't just get the toxic metals. They get some of the critical metals, and unless they're very tightly controlled, I think most physicians, even for kids with lead poisoning, don't recommend chelation unless the lead levels are really extraordinarily high. That's another area where there needs to be a lot more research on what can safely get rid of some of these toxic substances, because it's not well developed.
Dr. Carpenter, you didn't mention...
I wish you people would call me David.
The brain is a big, high concentration of fat. Do these pollutants pass the blood-brain barrier and get into the brain?
Oh, of course. They go right through all the membranes. So that really is the problem. They get in the brain. That's how they cause all these effects on IQ and memory function.
You were talking about the action items. I'm guessing you're still in high school.
Mm-hmm.
What do kids do almost all day, even during school?
Texting.
A creative way to pass it off is to do just a short visual high technology.
That's absolutely right.
Flip.
Yep.
Feed it to these leadership organizations within school.
Yep.
And it starts there and
yep.
starts talking. Sometimes face to face.
Well, I'm just so glad that Canton School, it seems to be really leading in many ways, because of the schools up here. I don't know of any other environmental clubs. I think the Canton School has had an environmental club for quite a long period of time. There's an environmental club at Gilderland Schools down near Albany. There's environmental clubs maybe at the college level. It would be good to deal with them too, because then you get environmental clubs at just about every college has some sort of environmental club.
My brother is in Florida Institute of Technology, and he's starting up an environmental club because he was in the one that I'm in now.
Okay, yes, they've existed a long time. You guys have truly been doing this. They've had an environmental club there. One of the coolest things I remember that they did. One of the people who was in the club actually got interested in the open burning issue. And he went then to the younger kids, like the kids in the middle school from the high school environmental club, and he was educating them about the open burning issue. Was your brother? Oh, cool. Huh. Didn't know that. Well, small world.
Yeah.
And so I think that maybe there's this middle ground environmental club at SUNY Potsdam. There's some clubs at St. Lawrence. The Clarkson has an eco club. There's the Canton Environmental Club. Well, so maybe if they just all got together, you know, that would inspire other groups to, you know, get going. With the EMC, you know, we have the Environmental Management Council. That's kind of like this environmental club, you know, in a lot of ways, with the county government. And I invited all those legislators here tonight. I invited all those legislators, those county legislators we have here tonight. There's a lot of new ones, and I did not invite them. I invited all the ones that exist at this time. They told me there was going to be budget discussions and they couldn't come, but then it ended up that there were no budget discussions, so some of them could have come. The only one that I know of that really had a good excuse was Joe Lightfoot, and he said he had some board town board meetings that he felt was important to go to. I guess they meet on Tuesday nights. So I think we need to lead them. We, the people, need to lead government. Oftentimes that's the case. It's truly always the case. So I'm just thinking if the environmental clubs kind of just get, it would be wonderful if they would choose to focus on what his, you know, what his knowledge is and what, you know, he can share, because, you know, it's this truly our group in making recommendations. Our major recommendations are that people would reduce their consumption of animal fat and they would reduce their exposure, their casual exposure to exhaust, because, you know, with the exhaust, you have this mixture of carcinogens. You know, with animal fat, you have this mixture of carcinogens. It's all well documented. And it certainly will be easy to just not eat animal fat or not eat very much of it. And it certainly is easy to not breathe exhaust. There's no reason to breathe it. You don't idle your car. You don't hang out with people that are idling their cars. You don't hang out on street corners. You just don't run around on long strings of motorcycles or ATVs or snowmobiles. It's pretty easy, really, not to breathe a lot of excess concentrated exhaust. And so I think if people would actually do that, they would significantly reduce their cancer risk. And I'm just happy that we have Dr. Carpenter here to show us the way.
Dinner on Thursday. Happy.
Yeah, they're doing great things, you know. This SUNY Potsdam Middle Ground group, they have a composting program that's going at SUNY Potsdam. I think they have some garden stuff going, some organic gardening going. And they're, you know, very active. You guys are very active. It's just great to see that as the new, as the future, you know. And I'm truly hoping, too, that the EMC will be part of it. You know, maybe the EMC and the college groups and the high school groups, because the EMC has been talking about doing this kind of educating, you know, that we've been discussing here quite some, you know, over the months. You know, they have become more and more kind of determined to do some of this kind of educating. So I think there's a lot of good hope for this message getting out there to the general public. And the truth of it is, they do not. I've had some of the county legislators say to me, well, don't they all know it? Don't, you know, this thing of animal fat, it has been, you know, stated in the, you know, the mainstream medical community and amongst, you know, average people, that animal fat is not healthy to eat. And so people have been, you know, thinking about not eating so much animal fat, but see, not specifically because of the matter of these pollutants being in the animal fat. There's none of that. There's no public knowledge. The general public has no knowledge of the presence of these pollutants in animal fat. And they need to know that for one reason, and it is this, that then they would be better environmentalists. They would have seen that this really terrible problem came to exist because of being careless with chemicals and not, you know, thinking about the whole outcomes of using chemicals. And just if they miss this, then they miss this huge chance to become much stronger environmentalists. I don't want people to just to like quit eating animal fat because they think it's unhealthy. I want them to quit eating it because it's unhealthy, because it's contaminated with these chemicals. We can make a lot of progress that way, and I just hate to miss that opportunity for our, you know, our people. I don't know. I don't have any questions for him. I don't have any more questions for him.
Actually, I have another question.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of confirmed behaviors in the world, and one thing they can do is they know it's not that other animal fats. Is there a significant difference in the level of bad stuff that you get?
Oh, yes, enormous difference. Because these contaminants are totally in the fat. So the more fat you consume, there's none of these chemicals in the meat. Now, unfortunately, we've all been brainwashed. We like our steaks very tender. Well, the meat fibers aren't more tender. The tender steak is because there's a lot of fat. And, you know, what Don says is right. Most people realize that fat isn't good for you because they're worried about saturated fats and heart disease. But they are oblivious to the fact that tender steak also has a lot of these contaminants. But, grass-fed beef, I raise grass-fed beef, and they're not nearly so tender. The steaks are a lot tougher. That's why a lot of people don't like them. Because we've gotten brainwashed into thinking a steak has to be something you can, cut with your fork. And grass-fed beef is not like that. some of the best meat that one can eat in terms of contaminant levels is venison.
I was just going to say that the hunters that are successful
Yeah. Right. They don't get fed animal fats. And they have very, very low levels of saturated fats. Actually, grass-fed beef and venison and elk and so forth actually have significant levels of omega-3 fatty acids, which grain-fed beef does not. And it comes, it's not the long chain fatty acids, but it's the 18 carbon chain. It comes from eating the nuts and the acorns and so forth.
Another question related to, with the outdoor burning ban, I think there's been a shift for people to have outdoor furnaces. And are those considerably more dangerous than an open burn barrel? I mean, as far as putting out dioxins and things like that?
Probably not in terms of dioxins, but now there's a bill pending with the legislature right now, I believe, to ban outdoor wood furnaces. The issue there is the air pollution, the particulates that are emitted. The dioxin is, you get some dioxin when you burn wood, but dioxin is primarily formed when you burn plastics.
I think a lot of those people with outdoor furnaces, though, are burning.
Well, I'm sure they are.
Yeah.
You know, you just look at all of the round bales wrapped in those plastics, and you can be pretty sure that a lot of those are going in the outdoor furnaces. So when you burn plastic, whether it's an outdoor furnace or a burn barrel, you're forming dioxins. Some dioxins are formed. They're formed by forest fires, by wood combustion, but not nearly at the levels that you have when you burn plastics.
So in your studies, have you ever done, I think people need visuals. They need to see a pile of fat.
Yes.
And they need to see it tested. They need to see a level. And it, in all your studies, have you done anything where it's that visual?
Well, I'm not sure we have, really.
Because that would be a good piece to pass on
that's
to
right.
the kids. Because they'd be like, ew, that's gross. That's why my daughter's a vegetarian. She did a paper when she was like 16.
Right.
Saw chickens all huddled up. And
right. Well, certainly the commercial agricultural methods for raising animals is really horrible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the best ways to demonstrate the contaminants in humans is not just from a blood sample, but from fat biopsies. And, you know, we actually have proposed that in some studies. Now, what you do is you take two humongous needles and you take butt samples. and it doesn't sound fun, and it clearly wouldn't be very, very pleasant. But that's the best way to get a measure of what really is in your fat.
But
and that could make a nice visual, I guess.
Yeah.
You're really selling it now, Doc.
We need some volunteers here, but I got the needles. If
Well, I would just like to say, I mean, I work for St. Lawrence County and our Environmental Management Council, and, you know, over the years, we've been very active in the open burning, hazards of open burning awareness campaign, and there's still some billboards up till the end of the year reminding people that it's now state law that you're not supposed to burn trash and that sort of thing. So in consistent with that effort, you know, we would like to continue making people aware of environmental hazards, and this is one of them. I think that the whole trick and the challenge for public health and for schools and anyone trying to get the word out is you have to give people information. You have to also give them options.
Right.
And you have to make them not leave or not walk away with a feeling like, oh, it's hopeless. No matter what I do, I'm surrounded by these things. I have no control over it. I might as well just do what I've been doing all along and take my chances and, you know, come see, come saw. So it's tempting to fall into that way of thinking. But because, you know, to look at things and analyze things and make decisions and make choices, there's a certain amount of work associated with that. And some people don't like to do that work. But I think you need to give people options. And some things were mentioned tonight in that regard. Eat locally. Lou said a lot of them. In addition to that, you need to you need to tell people that they need to question a lot of things. Be more bold about questioning, and you know, when they're in stores, ask questions. You know, let's get some feedback going back to the companies that are producing these things. Ask a lot of questions. Be good consumers. Be aware, and hopefully change will happen in that regard. And like Lou said again, vote with your wallet. So a combined strategy of all those things, I think, is what is going to affect change. There's no glib solution here. There's no glib program. It's a multiple thing. But I think, I'll just say in closing, if I were an educator of young people, I think what I would do is say, okay, I'd set out some food. Maybe do this during a lunch time, right in this room. Set out some food and say, okay, can anybody tell me where that food item came from? And, you know, have them say, trace it back, I mean, to as far back as they can, down the food chain, where did the pieces, parts come from that made that food that you're about to eat? And you know, some of the students will know more than others, and they'll say, well, this, you know, was fed this, and this was fed that, and I know because I grew up on a farm, and we used to raise this kind of animal, or whatever. And, you know, that'll be great, but then you need somebody who really knows the answers to say, well, are you aware that X, Y, and Z went into this? And including that was animal fats made from other animals, and et cetera, et cetera. And do you know what the consequences are of that? And use that, use the actual food as a teaching tool. I mean, I think young people would remember that lesson. And maybe every time they put food in their mouth, they'd say, oh, let's think about that. And, you know, that would be something that would keep coming back. So I've sort of blabbed on here. I'm sorry.
Those are good comments.
That's a good point.
Good points.
Yeah, I mean, I think another thing, you know, back during the incinerator debate, the Medical Society of the County got on board that debate. We don't have a lot of boutique doctors up here. We're kind of held hostage to the service providers we have, and we're kind of grateful for any that we can find.
Right.
But, you know, you may have a pretty unique opportunity, you know, to take Dr. Carpenter's research and share it in the medical community. We know from the North Country Symposium that, I can't remember the doctor cardiologist, but he comes and he lectures that group every year about the our habits in terms of eating and smoking and what it's doing, in his particular case, to our hearts and circulatory systems. But you've got some you know, pretty passionate doctors who decided to make a living up here despite the fact that that's hard to do. But the other thing is, it's a pretty small community. It's not like if you don't like the message, you can go somewhere else. If
you don't like the message. There's nowhere else to go, so I guess you get the message. And I think you've got a real chance if you can get some buy-in here, because as you've pointed out, Don, in any number of your presentations, some of the levels of the disease, various diseases, in your particular case, the cancers that you're interested in, are extraordinary in this county. And if we have hidden risk, I think that's a group of people that can easily identify that.
Yeah, I think that I've been talking to Dr. Palau. He's the head of the
Manny Palau.
Yeah, the medical society right now, and he said that he had been discussing with the members the possibility of Dr. Carpenter making a presentation to them. So maybe that will be a next step. You know, that they would tomorrow the Lisbon Town Board has given him 10 minutes to talk to them on the telephone. He's going to be back down in Albany at that time. But he's going to call them up at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, talk to the Lisbon Town Board about what he told the Canton Town Board. And the Canton Town Board, they have now gone to the point of writing letters to FDA and some of the, like, say, Congressman Owens and Gillibrand and Schumer. Canton Town Board wrote that letter, I think, months ago, really. It was Dr. Carpenter's did a conference, you know, a speakerphone call with the Canton Town Board. It was months ago, maybe like 2 or 3 months ago. It's quite some time ago. And they have written those letters, so they have been the first town up here, as far as I know, the first town anywhere, that's called up. And they wrote to FDA and asked FDA to ban this use of the waste animal fat in the food animal feeds. And we're just hoping some of the other towns would do that. It just takes voices. It just takes these, you know, the town boards and the, you know, the environmental clubs and the high schools and the county legislature. I'm really hopeful that, you know, they might even, you know,
should include people. The medical societies.
Yeah, the medical society, certainly. Yeah. And there's probably one in every county. So.
Well, Dan, time to go home.
It's done. Yep. I think we're done.
I think so.
Yep. Thank you very much. Well, thanks a lot for coming.
Thank you.